South Carolina's got everything. Natural beauty, trendy cities, but you might miss your next big adventure in a smaller town. We've got you covered on the Palmetto Porch, Discover South Carolina's official podcast. I'm Devin Whitmire. Come with me as I venture off the beaten path and learn about these towns from the locals who know them best. Check out the Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information, head on over to scpalmettoporch.com.
True Crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host. I'm Jen Coffendaffer. I am so excited to meet with you guys again for the second time today to discuss a case that I think is going to be one that we are going to see in the media and center stage for quite a long time. And it involves a case that took place in Frisco, Texas, of all places, which I'm very familiar with. It's north of Dallas. It's a beautiful suburb. It's where many Dallas Cowboys live. It's where many affluent people live. It's just a lovely community. And I point this out because tragic instances and crime happen everywhere. It doesn't matter how affluent a community is, how calm a community is, it can happen anywhere. In this particular case, you had a track meet going on, and it was involved where two different high schools, well, multiple high schools, but particularly this case involves a student from Centennial and a student from Memorial. So the student from Memorial, his name was Austin Metcalf, and he was a standout football player. He was a standout track star. He was a very well-regarded member of the high school. Definitely on the religious side, at least from the post we've seen on his social media. And just, I think, generally, you know, very well regarded. The individual that was also involved in this case, so Austin was the victim, the suspect and accused killer of Austin Metcalf, his name is Carmelo Anthony. Now, he was from a school very close by, Centennial, also in Frisco, and he was also a standout. He was captain on his football team. He was a standout track star. And just in a nutshell, what happened was for some reason, and we don't know why, but Carmelo went to the tent of where Austin Metcalf was and his track team. Now, personally, I have a kid who runs track. My other kids didn't. I ran track all through high school. And I can tell you now these kids, these schools, they set up these tents for those of you who aren't in this culture. And they're large tents. They typically have the name of the school on them. Typically the coaches are in there. The kids are in there. They have chests with water and refreshments and things for the athletes. They're all in there stretching, they're talking, they're waiting for their events. This is where the team goes to basically get together and commiserate when they are not running their event. For some reason, Carmelo Anthony decided to go to the opposition's tent, and he was there in the tent. And apparently, he had a duffel bag, and Austin had told him when he saw him there, you know, you need to leave. And apparently Carmelo opened up his bag, according to police reports, and said, if you touch me, you know, look out. Actually, I have the exact words he said, because I don't want to paraphrase too much. But he says, the exact words are, touch me and see what happens, just to not paraphrase. Touch me and see what happens. And then Austin Metcalf touched him, according to the report, touched him. At that point, Carmelo Anthony says, And again, I want to be very specific. Punch me and see what happens. At that point, Austin did not punch him, but he grabbed him. And at that point, Carmelo Anthony pulled a knife and stabbed Austin in the chest. And Austin died. Carmelo then ran away, ditched the knife in the stands, and those are the facts. But I want to get into this with a very, very special guest. He's a friend of the program. I call him that because I've had him on before. His name is Daryl James, and Daryl James was a captain in the Marines. He was an FBI special agent for 26 years. He was on the SWAT team for over a decade, for years, well over a decade. He was a SWAT team leader. In fact, he was one of my SWAT team leaders on Gold Team in the Dallas division. This guy is as together and as well-respected as anyone you will find that has served in the FBI. And I just look up to him for his common sense approach to cases. And without further ado, because I could talk all day about DJ, DJ, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jennifer. Good evening and good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too. All right, you've got that shining halo, right?
I know.
So funny, we were working on it before the program started because I hated him to just look like this big, you look like an angel. There, that's better. You
look better? Okay.
Look a little less angelic. So I sent Daryl today some of the paperwork, specifically the police reports. And I want to actually add onto the stage here just a couple of items. First of all, I do want to put, of course, a picture of the victim up on the stage. This is Austin Metcalf and one of his accolades. DJ, tell me, this is your community. This is right where you hail from. Another reason why I wanted to have DJ on. Tell us what this case and what's happened has meant to your community.
Well, obviously, when it happened, like you said, I believe it was April 2nd. Just surprise. Obviously, you never think anything. You know, you hear this on the news all the time, right? Anything like this can happen, especially among kids, teenagers, students in the district here. And like you said, you described the community very well. Frisco, at one time, I think it was the fastest growing city in the United States, all that type of stuff. But it would be considered a quote unquote affluent, I guess, suburb community just north of Dallas. And people move here, I always say, for the school system, right? It's the schools are very good. And so when you hear about something like this happening amongst these students, and then, obviously every area has its crime, but when you start hearing the background of each of these students, I mean, they were considered to be very good students. And so it's surprising, and it's been pretty much the talk of the community for the last 5 or 6 days.
You know, I tell you, DJ, I was at home working on some things, and my phone started lighting up, particularly from a bunch of my, obviously I play tennis there, from my tennis community, and just saying, oh my gosh, you're not going to believe this. This student stabbed another student. We can't believe it. This, you know, it's just a mess. And then, of course, I started looking on mainstream media, and it hadn't really even hit yet. And I think there's been a lot of sort of speculation as to how this could happen. I want to pull up. Actually, I didn't want to pull up that picture. This is Carmelo Anthony from last year's. Last year he was a captain. I wanted to let you know, everybody know, he's about 5'9", 130.
Yeah.
He's little and a very slight built. And the victim in this case, Austin Metcalf, He's a big guy. 6 foot. I think he was over, I think he was 180. I need to pull that stat up and I will. This was easy for me to get from his arrest records for Carmelo. But what did you think, DJ, when you initially read this report?
The police reports, it's kind of what you expect as you read each responding officer as they showed up. You know, first of all, as you know, Jennifer, when you get a call, you're trying to get some situational awareness, right? You get the call, dispatch sends you there, a stabbing, they get there, and immediately the people there, whether they were the participants in the track event, coaches, fans, direct them, the police officers, to the victim and to the subject, who are both still there inside the stadium. And the officers go about explaining their actions. They were directed and they went over and they talked to people either at the tent where the victim was, and then they went over to the subject, and the subject was arrested. So it was what you would expect, a law enforcement response. Like I said, initially, when you get to a situation like that, you're trying to figure out what's going on. And then once you figure out what's going on and have it contained, you try to figure out why it happened.
Well, and I wanted to say something that I don't know if it exactly struck me, but something that I think many people might not be aware of. But the first responding officers in this day and age aren't the local departments. They're the actual school resource officers that are pretty much assigned now full-time status to these different high schools, because unfortunately there are so many events, you know, between active shooters and between violence now in the classrooms and on campuses. There's a set officer and multiple for me, for the most part, back in the day, that wasn't really the way it was, but it is full on now, full staff within the last, I would say, 10 to 15 years. Has that been your experience too?
Yes. So here in Frisco, yeah, we have school resource officers who are Frisco City police officers that are assigned. And generally, like you said, they'll be definitely at a high school and then at the middle school. And they're assigned an elementary school, but usually they kind of stop in during the day. They spend more of their time either at the high school or middle school. But yeah, the Frisco has the full-time resource officers that are assigned to each school.
And you know, I have found that, and I'm not going to say anything at all derogatory or in any way do I mean this to be in a negative. But I will say from my experience, and it's for a very specific reason, a lot of the school resource officers, not always, but often, they are on sort of the twilights of their career, or they're in a situation where they need to have very specific set hours, which police officers don't really have that. In other words, maybe it's a paternity leave situation. Maybe they have a young child and they need to have more normalized hours. But these are not usually officers that are used to dealing with homicides and are, adept at exactly what to do. And what I did see, and I don't know if you noticed this, just a couple of things. And again, I'm not trying to Monday morning quarterback, but I'm trying to point out things that I think might prove interesting as we go down the road with prosecution. As an example, the first officer on scene, he is told, listen, that guy was just stabbed over there. And then, you know, that's who stabbed him, but he doesn't get the name of the witness and he never identifies him. And to their credit, as DJ said, when you first go onto a scene, especially a chaotic, it was raining, you've got all these teams, you have all this, chaos, you're just trying to get a handle on what in the world happened. DJ, do you want to talk a little bit about just that feeling of being sort of, I'm not going to say overwhelmed, but that feeling of, okay, I got to get this under control. because I don't even know what I have here.
Yeah, well, and yeah, first of all, just address, like, so the fiscal resource officers and the ones that I've known personally have been seasoned officers. Like, some of them have been sergeants. I've known them for a while. And so it just depends. I'm sure there's a mix. But like you said, yeah, when you respond to a situation like that, and I noticed that too. One of the things in the first officer that responded to the scene, he said, I forgot if it was a coach or fan who directed him to the tent. And he said, you know, he made a statement. I didn't get the witness's ID, but his job, right, is to contain, like I said, contain that situation and make sure it's safe. So his first priority is finding out what's going on and if I need to take any actions to contain this situation and to make sure this is a safe situation. So I can see why he's not stopping to take names. He's not writing anything down. He wants to make sure he's got a good handle on what's going on. One, so he could do his job and protect the public. And two, he can let the other officers, as they respond, he can provide them with some type of intel to let them know what's going on. And he's probably, like, depending on those follow-on officers or detectives to come in and actually start doing the actual investigation, like you said, identifying witnesses and all that type of thing. But as you know, the first thing you've got to do is contain that situation and make sure it's safe as quickly as possible.
Well, and I'm so glad you pointed that out, because I didn't do a good job of pointing that out. Number one, when you have your reporting, or you, it's been reported to you that you're responding to a stabbing and you're dispatched, you have no idea, is this a suicide? Is this a suicidal, you know, person on a terror? You know, what do you even have? And to make sure that all the other individuals are safe, you need to immediately identify where the threat is, if it's contained, and what's going on. So a lot of people really are hard in the sleuth and in the circles of true crime. You know, they expect everything to be perfect, DJ. Oh my gosh, you can't make one mistake. You can't overlook one thing. And that's just not the reality of the chaos in these situations you come upon.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And like I said, that officer, he's the first one there. He's got to make sure, like you said, is this a stabbing? Is it, as we know, with all the, school violence, shooting incidents, things like that, he wants to make sure you don't have something like that. So he wants to first identify victims. He wants to identify whoever the suspect or suspects are in a situation, and contain that and address that as quickly as possible. And like I said, then the investigation will follow up after that. But his job is to make sure that situation is safe as quickly as possible.
And I think he did a good job with that, you know, responding, figuring out what was happening, and quite quickly, actually, they were able to identify the suspect, Carmelo Anthony, really pretty quickly from what I can ascertain. And that's not a difficult feat. As we saw from the police reports, unfortunately, Austin died basically in the arms of his twin brother. Has the community there been discussing any of that, DJ?
Yeah, like I said, it's obviously just a terrible situation. And like, it is better, it can't be better or worse, I guess, anytime a child is killed. But yeah, to die in the arms, for his twin brother to actually be there at that track meet, and he died in his arms, again, for the family, just another bit of heartbreak for it to happen the way it happened. And so that's been a big thing. And like you said, I mean, and for your viewers, it's, again, describing Frisco, it's, even though it's grown a lot over the last 25 years or whatever, it's still a relatively small, tight-knit community. So when something like this happens, everybody, people know people, because somebody's kids, like that my age, somebody's kids go to school at Centennial, or they go to school at Memorial. So they know these kids, right? And you talk to the parents of other children who go to school with them, who played sports with them. So this, that's the type of community this is. It's fairly, you know, even for a large, growing, quickly expanding community, it's fairly close knit. Everybody knows somebody who knows somebody, especially at these schools, because like I said, a lot of the community is centered around the schools in the community.
So I found it very interesting that Carmelo Anthony, upon his arrest, made a lot of statements. And quite frankly, three of them were pretty incriminating. One of them was mitigating, I felt. But I wanted the viewers to understand what we in law enforcement know as spontaneous utterances. And the fact that spontaneous utterances, although these might be argued, are typically always allowed in court. It's what you say without any questioning, and those are going to be allowed in court. What did you think about the spontaneous utterances that he said?
Yeah, like you said, and you can see in the report, the officers made sure to point that out, that they were spontaneous. Yeah, so for, again, your viewers who may not know, obviously, when you're arrested, you read your Miranda rights, which you have the right to remain silent, right? First one, you have the right to remain silent. And so anything you say, you know, can and will be used against you. But even before that, if you do make a quote unquote spontaneous utterance, before the, basically that's saying before the officer even had a chance to read you your rights, then that can be used. And that's why they're included in the officer's reports as they responded to the scene. And he did make statements that the prosecution is going to use, right? And to your point, the defense will use some to show that this may have been something else. It may have been self-defense. It may have been some other act, because he did say things that, that again, spontaneously, without thinking about it, without having a chance to, you know, come up with it in his mind, that could point to that. So I'm sure they're going to be used on both sides. There's probably going to be a lot of legal back and forth on whether what gets in and what doesn't get in, but it would be hard to see that these spontaneous utterances don't get into court if it goes to court, if it goes to trial.
Right. Yeah. No, I 100% agree with you. And I think, DJ, this will go to trial. I can't imagine it not going to trial from what at least I'm seeing in mainstream media, social media, and then also seeing just what's occurring in, unfortunately, this whole atmosphere in our country. Things I'm seeing, I hate it, because it's steering away from the facts. In other words, because a white young man was murdered and a black young man is accused of that murder, it's automatically made into a race situation. And I'm just not seeing that from the facts we see here. But what are you hearing? What is it sounding like in the community there? And what are you seeing?
Well, yeah, like you pointed out, obviously on a national scale, and I know that's the racial part of it has been played up. Not so much hearing about that here locally and in the community. I mean, and it is very interesting that this story, tragic as it is, because a young man lost his life, has made such national news. And I was talking to somebody the other day, and so in Fort Worth, which you're very familiar with, you worked in Fort Worth, there was a father and I think a five-year-old daughter killed execution style at a car wash, like at 5 a.m. And this happened maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago. And you know, these two guys, I guess, pull up, end up killing them. Fort Worth police do a great job. They catch them like 2 days later. But I don't know if you've even heard about that nationally. I mean, it's tragic, right? It's a father and his five-year-old daughter were gunned down in the car at a car wash, which, like, you know, one murder is no more tragic than the other. But I'm just saying, from a, you know, wow, I can't believe this happened. A five-year-old, you know, gets gunned down with her dad. And again, I don't know all the details and why it happened. If it was an execution, I don't know. But that didn't make the national news, as far as I know. I never heard anything else about it except here locally when they apprehended the two guys. But this immediately made national news. And like you said, the racial component obviously is a big part of that. And a part of where it happened, right? Again, when you talk about Frisco, and you talked about it earlier, right? You got the, you know, football players, professional football players live here, and the Cowboys, it's the headquarters for the Cowboys, and, you know, the headquarters for the PGA and all these other things. And so I think all that stuff kind of it's something that becomes a focal point that the people, the media kind of keys in on, versus a double homicide that happened at a car wash somewhere in Fort Worth, you know, bigger city, right? Unfortunately, they have homicides that happen a lot more than happen in a small town like Frisco. But it just shows how things, you know, can get painted one way or another. And then nationally, it becomes a story when most people don't know that it happened. If you don't live here in the Metroplex, you didn't hear about it on the news.
Yeah, this is really blown up. Like I said, I knew about it before it hit mainstream media. Interestingly, I did not catch the Fort Worth case, because that would have been one I would have wanted to highlight. You can bet I will be highlighting that on my Twitter, X. You can bet that for sure. I'll look into that, DJ. But to your point, two vicious murders, execution style of a five-year-old. And yet this stabbing is very well elevated for the reasons we see are obvious. And that's racially, I think, raised. But I have so many questions for your opinion on this. First of all, I know you and I kind of touched on this, but there was something that I found in the social media realm and concerning Carmelo. And this picture, and I just want to say this picture, this is a broader picture. There's other people in this picture. There is a white person in this picture. I just drew it down to this for no other reason than I wanted to draw attention to this particular hand signal. And I also did not want to put other people's faces all over social media, you know. And I don't even know what to say about this weapon anymore. I'm always reluctant unless I can personally inspect a weapon, because, as you know, DJ, yes, does that look like an AK? Absolutely. Is it one? I don't know, because of all the amazing knockoffs. I don't see anything orange on it indicating that it's not real. You would think this pose he has going on that he's bragging about it. But what bothered me with this particular photo, working gangs for 6 years in Fort Worth, as you pointed out, was this particular sign I see. And it's this sign. It's where the left ring finger descends and the other fingers are up. And that is just an insane Vice Lord sign and signal. Could this just accidentally be that he pulled his finger down? Do I think he's a raging gangbanger? No. Do I think he could be a wannabe or something like that? It's possible. DJ, I know you didn't work gangs, because DJ was way smarter than me and he worked white collar crime. But when I was looking at these, and by the way, their colors are red and black, so I noticed that also. But you don't know of any particular gang activity going on there that you've seen in the news or anything, do you?
No, that's when you told me about this, it was surprising. Like, I haven't heard about any that type of gang activity here in Frisco. And you really, obviously, like you said, we both worked in Dallas and Fort Worth for several years, so you heard about it in Dallas, but you don't hear about it a lot in Dallas anymore as far as national gangs, like you said, Vice Lords, you know, Bloods, Crips, that type of thing. I'm sure there's local neighborhood everywhere, right, gangs. But, yeah, I haven't heard of any association with Carmelo Anthony being affiliated with any of that. But just like you can find this on social media, the prosecution will find this on social media, right? And so it will become part of the story, I'm sure. And then just like you said, the context of it, we don't know. Is this even his weapon? Is it one of the other people who, like you said, are in this photo and they're letting him hold it and everybody wants to, right, look real cool, especially 16, 17 year old kids, you know, holding a big gun. And again, it's what you tell kids every day, be careful what you put on social media, you never know, right? And so, but that's just part of the world we live in now with the social media and all that stuff. But yeah, no, to answer your question, yeah, there's been no association that I've heard of with him being involved in any type of gang activity.
And I also wanted to point out, because I want to paint a very fair picture here, and although I don't have those photos, I know there are hunting photos of Austin Metcalf, you know, with his buddies and, you know, hunting, right? He's all camoed out and he's got rifles and what I consider hunting firearms. And in one of those pictures, he's given what I think of as the hang 10, you know, hang loose sign.
Right, right.
And, you know, there's hook'em horns there and there's all sorts of signs, right? So I just want to be fair to say that certainly Austin Metcalf was pictured with hunting rifles. But I also want to point out that the obvious, and that is that Austin Metcalf is the victim. Austin Metcalf is dead. And it's Carmelo Anthony that to me is going to be under a microscope in terms of any associations, in terms of any bravado, because it leads me to this question. And that is, what in the heck was he doing under an opponent's tent with a knife at a track meet? Why? Give me some thoughts. I know we're just looking at facts. The facts are what I just said, but we're hypothetically saying why this could be possible from our experiences. What do you think?
Well, like you said, and any of this would obviously be speculation, and that gets to be a little... You don't want to get too far abroad, but it could be any reasons. You've been to track meets. It could be hot, right? And you're talking about, again, it's Frisco. These schools are all close together. A lot of times the kids know each other because obviously they compete for their schools, but they compete in AAU competitions where there's basketball. They compete on track teams in the summer, right, where they're all on different track teams together. So he could have been visiting somebody at another, you know, from another school, whatever the reason. Again, speculation, but initial thought is obviously he didn't go over there to confront Austin because Austin walked up to him. So he wasn't like over there to confront him. He was over there to do something else, right? I don't know why he was over there sitting under their tent, but he was over there either talking to somebody else or whatever, or, you know, the view from there was better than the view from his team's tent. But he didn't go over there, my initial thought, to confront Austin, because he's over there sitting down when Austin, according to the reports that I've heard, the witness reports, is Austin walks up to him and tells him he needs to move. So, that's going to be interesting. But as we know, you know, they're kids. And like I said, it could have been a number of reasons why he would have gone to another team's tent, especially at a track meet. It's not kind of not like a football game or even a basketball game where you go to the other team's sideline, right? You know, you're not going to be welcome there in the middle of track meets or a little different. Like I said, a lot of these kids end up, they compete against each other, but then they compete together on these different track teams that are run all over the Metroplex.
See, that's DJ. This is why I have you on, because I always love the counterpoint, because of course my initial thought was, why in the world is he under that tent? I'm thinking from a different vantage, just literally from being at a track meet a week ago. And I can tell you there's none of those other kids are going underneath the high school tent of another, right? They don't. But you bring up such a great point. They do compete on basketball teams and elite football 7-on-7s and other teams.
7-on-7, yep.
Yeah, so they could have friends, and he could have been there for you know, another purpose that was completely innocent. You know, hey, I was talking to my buddy who, you know, I ran 7-on-7 with or something, right?
Right.
So I love that you brought up that point, because for me, I was looking at it as so unusual, but maybe it wasn't that unusual.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I said, you got a child involved in track, right? Track and field, even at the high school level, is a lot of friends and family events, right? It's not a big crowd that usually shows up at especially event during the middle of the day. I mean, that's just the way it is. I mean, they're great, you know, great athletes, but it's not football, it's not basketball or even baseball where you get, you know, draw these big crowds and everybody shows up for the games. So yeah, the kid, I mean, it's going to be a lot more movement around, and it's not that type of atmosphere that you get at a, especially in Texas, right? Big high school football game where, yeah, nobody's talking to anybody. Once that whistle blows, right? You're going at it for the next 60 minutes or whatever it is in high school now. But yeah, that's, I can say, I think track is a little more, it's one-on-one, it's an individual sport. And so people are moving around, and not everybody competes in every event, right? So you may not even compete against a kid from another high school because they run the 400 and you run the 100, or they're a distance runner, or, you know, whatever it is. Or there's a girl over there you want to talk to, or whatever it is. So, yeah.
All right. So let me take it a step further, because we've talked about kind of some different angles of why he could be under this tent. Who brings a knife to a track meet?
Yeah, and that's going to be the interesting part, right? The question is, why would he have the knife in his bag? And I don't know. I haven't seen or heard the description of the weapon, right? It's a knife. Is it a 3-inch blade? Was it a kitchen knife? I don't know, all right?
I've heard a black knife.
Right.
And I don't think it was a fixed blade. That was the general reporting from somebody who had seen it. Actually, I think I posted it on my Twitter, a picture of it. And if I'm thinking of it, it was probably a total of 6 inches, about a 3-inch blade. As I recall, don't get mad at me, folks, if I'm wrong, but I posted it, I believe, on my Twitter. So, you know, it was something that I think somebody could have to hunt with, right? I mean, you could have it.
Right. Just like earlier you were talking about Austin Metcalf and, you know, pictures with it. I mean, like, we live in Texas. It's a hunting culture. Kids, especially his age, 16, 17 year olds, often hunt with their parents, their fathers, mothers, uncles, whomever. So, yeah, it's not unusual to see them with weapons and just like knives. Right. Like you said, they're hunting knives. Now, I think for me, it would be unusual for a kid to have a knife in their bag, one, at school, and two, at a school event. So it'll be interesting to hear the explanation, and I haven't heard anything yet on why he had that. And then that's going to bring in, you know, not, this is not your subject tonight, but a whole nother thing that you and I have both dealt with, is security at events, right? Event security. This is a sporting event. What do you allow in and what don't you allow in? And I'm sure there will be some adjustments to, do you search bags now going into these kind of events and that type of thing? We know spectators, right, are often searched or have to go through a magnetometer. Or are the participants now going to have the same type of thing? So we'll see.
Yeah, it's interesting. I really personally can't imagine, as you well said, taking a knife into a school. It's a prohibitive weapon, period. They're like, think of it on as a plane. What you can't have on a plane, you certainly can't have in a school, right? You can't have knives, you can't have guns, you can't have weaponry, really, of any sort. And this was a school event. But let's put that aside and talk about the facts here that we know, at least from multiple witnesses per the police reports that we've been reviewing. The fact that, if it's true, again, we're hearing it from multiple people, and it's been, you know, consummated on a police report, that Anthony was approached to get out of the tent. And I'm sure it wasn't like, oh, do you mind going over to your tent? I'm sure it was nothing like that. I'm sure it's like, hey, what are you doing here? Get the heck out of here. Or, you know, stronger than that, probably. But although the reports don't talk about any cussing, they don't talk about anything like that. So let me stick with the reports and not add in all of that. All we know is that he is asked to leave. That's what we know. And he opens up his bag, meaning Carmelo at that point, opens up his bag and puts his hand in. Correct me if I'm wrong here, DJ. That's what I believe I remember reading. Puts his hand in the bag.
Right.
And says, as I said before, touch me and see what happens. And that supposedly, it does say he reached in the bag. And that supposedly, the witnesses said they didn't think anything of it. Like, in other words, nobody thought he was going to pull out a gun or a knife or any dangerous weapon. They just, quote, didn't think anything of it. And then it escalates again because he touches them. And he says, oh, now punch me and see what happens.
Right.
And then, of course, that's when, bam, stab. I thought it was interesting, DJ. And did you find this interesting just from cases you've had? Only one stab. What did you think about that? That really struck me.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And I hadn't thought a lot about it, but obviously we know, right? So you hear about victims who were stabbed multiple times, right? And you think that's some type of crime of passion, right? You say they found this person stabbed 20 times or 30 times. You're like, okay, obviously this was a crime of passion. They were, you know, this goes deeper than just somebody was robbing somebody or whatever. But one time in this instance, and again, I'm no expert on this, but it tells me it's just like you said, nobody, when he said, touch me and see what happens, right? Or punch me and see what happens. Again, having a very long time ago, been a 17-year-old male, right? The machismo and all that comes out, right? And the kids that are around them, don't, because you hear that stuff all the time, right? Don't put your hands on me. That's just guys being guys. And so that's why they didn't think anything of it, because here too, you know, they're athletes and they're macho. And, you know, one guy walks up to another one and, you know, it's all that. And they thought at the worst, there'd be some pushing and shoving, right? That's kind of how guys do, right? Especially at that age. But the fact that he only stabbed him once, you make a very good point. I don't know, again, not being an expert, but it led me to think, you know, it's a reactionary deal or a reactionary thing to basically get him off you, right? It's just like if you punch somebody once. If somebody comes up and pushes you and you just throw one punch, right, you're just doing it to try to get them off of you, get them away from you, right? Now, if you still throw multiple punches and you knock them down and climb on top of them, and right, then you're taking it, it's a whole nother deal. And again, like you said, you stabbed him once, and then he and the report I think I read said he ran away. I don't know. I think I remember ran, not walked, right? Yeah. And I'm going off of memory now. Yeah. So again, and it goes back to what I said earlier. He wasn't looking for him. He wasn't there to confront Austin Metcalf, right? Carmelo Anthony wasn't there to confront him. He was there for some other reason. This situation develops while he's there, and for whatever reason, he felt he had to defend himself by using a knife. So, and that's going to go back to the defenses, right? They're going to use that to say all those things we just talked about for their case, to say, it, you know, he's going to claim self-defense, and here's why it was self-defense.
Again, that's why I love having you on the show, because I'm going to have to take a little bit different stance, because typically, unless you're you hitting me in the jaw, which could knock me out, typically one punch isn't going to kill somebody.
Oh, right. Well, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Everyone above the age of, say, 7, 8 years old knows if you take a knife and you stab it into somebody, there's a good chance they're not going to live. I think pretty much we know that it's a possibility they could die is probably a better way to put it.
Yeah, I would think, again, and looking at it today, there's a possibility. You know you're going to seriously injure them, no doubt, right? Would you stab somebody? But I don't know, for, you know, putting, again, going back to the mind of a 17-year-old, because then you get into intent, right? Did he intend, or was it, like I said, was he trying to just get him off of him using a weapon, a knife, to do it, which obviously wasn't the right thing to do because you're using a knife. But it's going to go back. You mentioned earlier, there's a size difference, right?
There is.
Pretty big size difference, probably at least 50, if not 60 or 70 pound difference in the two young men. So all those things are going to come into play. The prosecution is going to say he used a weapon he shouldn't have had. And why did he use a weapon? And the defense is going to say he felt threatened and he felt he had to defend himself. And the guy was a lot bigger.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what he's going to say. But this isn't like he was in a dark alley in, you know, a big city surrounded by a mob, and somebody gave him a push and gave him a nudge and he felt like he had to defend himself. You know, are you familiar with the case of, this happened in San Antonio, I believe, maybe even New Braunfels on the river? I don't know if you're familiar with this case. It just happened less than a year ago, I believe. And a bunch of kids, you know how everybody rafts down the Guadalupe?
All right.
Have you ever done that?
I have not done it, no.
Oh, it's so fun. There was another agent, Marty. I won't say his last name, but Marty had a cabin there. And he would always have the squad over. This was in Houston. And we'd all go. You'd get these big tubes and you'd just literally float down the, I believe it was the Guadalupe for hours. We'd all do that and then end up having a car come take us back. Okay, that's neither here nor there. But what happened was on one of these floats, you had all these kids that were in their 20s or so, 18, 19, 20. And basically there was a older gentleman in his 60s and they started surrounding him and they got in this huge fight with him and he was, you know, feeling very threatened and he had a knife, as I recall, and he stabbed one and he died. The kid died. He was like 17 or 18 and he died.
Right.
And I ran off and he actually threw his weapon somewhere. You know, he didn't stay on scene. He did what this kid did.
Right.
You know, this kid ditched his weapon. This guy ditched his weapon. I think I'm getting the facts about right. It's been a while since I've looked at this case. But it went to trial. And DJ, he claimed self-defense. And
right.
That, to me, was a bit of a self-defense case.
Yeah.
I can see you in your 60s, I think he was, and being terrified of all these drunk teenagers.
Right.
And he was found guilty. He was found guilty. And I was really surprised about that case. I was surprised that a Texas jury found him guilty. And it reminds me just the teeniest bit of this case. Not exactly. I think his was way worse. But I'm just saying this, DJ, is you can't bring a knife to a fist fight. I mean, really, that's way too escalating. I understand there's a big size difference. But Texas track meet, you're really.
Yeah. Well, and that's going to be the issue that he has. Like, you're at a school function. Why do you have this weapon? Now, I will say, and you know, as a law enforcement officer, and we've seen this a lot, right? Police officer shoots somebody who's unarmed, but they're fighting with that person, right? And then, and as we were taught, if you're in a fight, you're in a gunfight because you bring the gun. So, the deal is if you happen to have a weapon and the other person doesn't, but if they start a fight and you feel threatened, you know, at what point are you allowed to use that weapon? We can go back to the Trayvon Martin deal, right, in Florida, where I can't remember the guy who ends up shooting Trayvon, right? He confronts him. They get in a fight. Trayvon is winning the fight. He ends up shooting him. Right? Because he said now it's self-defense. So like the guy, Trayvon had gotten the advantage. And I thought he was going to, you know, hurt me or serious body injury or possibly kill me. Although I confronted him, and I brought the gun, I ended up using the gun, and he was found not guilty, right?
Yep.
So it's, you know, it's like I said, it's going to be an interesting case. And a lot is going to depend. You were talking earlier about what was actually said.
Yes.
And what happened under that tent the seconds before the stabbing, right? What happened and what those witnesses, because I think there were witnesses around there. You're under a tent. There were probably other students there. What they heard and the mood of the confrontation. Was it, you know, like you said, you know, the terminology is interesting. You said he was asked to move. Or was he asked or was he told? Or was he, right? Because that goes to your frame of mind. Somebody walks up to you and says, hey, get out of my seat. And you look at him and say, okay, I'm getting a minute. He said, no, you got to go now, right? It becomes confrontational. And so versus somebody says, excuse me, you're in my seat, right? It's the tone, all those things play into it. So it's going to be interesting to see what all these witnesses, you know, things we haven't heard, and we probably won't hear a lot of it until trial, how that starts to play out. Because I think they said it was 70 witnesses or something. It's something I heard report on the news, something like the Frisco Police Department had interviewed like 70 witnesses, which it is a track meet. So there are a lot of people out there. So there's going to be a lot of information that comes out between now and whenever this deal does go to trial.
Is the witnesses also that saw the person ditch the knife? It's that, you know, that he was running. Where was he running to? Did he say anything to anybody? You know, there are so many people that could be called as witnesses that could have seen a whole bunch of different things. We don't know what happened, as DJ mentioned. Why in the world did he go under that tent? There could be witnesses that know exactly why he went there, because he could have said, I'm going to go see my buddy over here under this tent.
Right. Yeah, his frame of mind before he even went over, like you said, and that's going to be a good point. Why was he there? Did he tell anybody, hey, I'm going over here, like you said, to talk to my buddy? Or did he tell somebody, I'm going over here to look for Austin Metcalf, right? Like I said, I don't think that happened because Metcalf ends up walking up to him. But either way, I mean, that will play a part, I think, in how, if you're on a jury, right, those facts are going to have the frame of mind of each of those people, the victim and Carmelo, is going to be what happened in this situation, what led up to it. And, you know, off the top, you just think it's a simple open and shut deal, right? How many people saw this happen? One person stabbed the other person. But it's going to be a lot more complicated than that once you get down to it.
I think it will be more complicated. And by the way, I just did look at their stats again. 5'9", 130 pounds. I mean, I have a kid who's younger than him and weighs more than that.
Right.
My kid's teeny. My kid's like, I call him the midget. You know, he's 5'7". And then you have, I just looked up the stats. You have Austin is 6'1", 225. And only reason. Even say that, DJ, and as you know, we always tease around, right? It's really the dog. It's not the dog of the fight. It's the fight and the dog. You know, in other words, you can be small and win a lot physically, but you have to look at that. Were you at Quantico? You might have already been gone. What were you, 90?
I was 92, 92.9.
You were 92.9? Oh, wow. Man, I'm older than you. Dang it.
I'm a baby, Jennifer. So.
You just really have more experience than you. Life than you, more years than you. Dang, that's bad news. Well, anyway, then you definitely were there in Quantico. But when I was there at Quantico, and I know you guys did this too, because this was before things got kinder and gentler, you know, 10 years later. Right. But boxed. And I mean, when I say people boxed, we had black eyes, we had bloody noses. That's how it rolled with my class. And our fit instructor, Mr. Smith, who played football for Virginia Tech as a running back, and they called him Stonehead. Anyway, he was a tough guy.
Yeah, he was my my class counselor. Yeah, Larry Smith. Yeah.
Yes, you went to class counselor. Well, you know, he was a tough old bird. But anyway, what bringing up, and what I will never forget and will always stick with me, was, you know, Steve Gomez, right? 6'2", 2
right.
And he was my boxing partner just because of how we fell in line.
Right.
We were boxing, and they felt he was taking it too easy on me because I'm 5'1" and he's 6'2", 180
Right.
And they said, come on, you know, you want to make sure that you can have your bell rung and still be able to stay in the fight. That was really the point of boxing in part.
Right.
So I'm like, Gomer, don't worry. I am so ready for this. And I'm like up like this. I'm like, go ahead, you know, give me a big one. Don't just, you know, because I didn't want him to get in trouble. He gives me one right in the jaw, DJ, knocked me totally out. Just even with my little head thing. And then I got the concussion, like one pupil was smaller than the other, and I had to stay out of DTs for a week. It was so humiliating and embarrassing, quite frankly. But anyway, my point to that is, if the first guy does get the punch in, if the, you know, and if you're, you have a huge size difference, they can kill you. Like,
oh yeah, I mean, obviously, I mean, especially if they knock you down, you hit your head on something. But yeah, I mean, it caused serious injury, knock you out. Yeah, I mean, you know, it obviously, like you said, less likely if you punch somebody or push somebody to seriously injure them. Although you're going to probably injure them or cause a concussion, like in your case. So yeah, and like you said, so all that's going to be played up, and I didn't realize the size difference was that significant when you just said the kid Austin was 6'1", 225. I mean, he's, you know, for a high school 17-year-old, I knew he was a football player, that's a big kid, right? He's my size.
Yeah, basically. He's your size, DJ.
Yeah. And so and then the other kid, like you said, 5'9", 130. Much while, you know, he almost is outweighed by 100 pounds. So again, like I said, all those things are going to come out and be played up by one side or the other in this case. So it's probably going to build up more nationally rather than go down. Right. It's going to be as things slowly come out, how each side, the defense plays it, and then how the prosecution decides to look at it. It's going to be interesting to see how this goes and where this goes. And hopefully, I mean, you know, our community will stay together throughout this and let the justice system decide what happens.
Yeah, the last thing I wanted to talk to you about, and I was hoping to stay under 45 minutes. It's always my goal, seems to run over that, but we've got to just talk about these spontaneous utterances really quick. Because there's something he says, meaning Carmelo, that I think is really sort of disturbing. And that was when he said, it's not alleged, I did it. And I found that to be very odd. I mean, DJ, seriously, how often do you find somebody that just stabbed somebody, do they want to say, and maybe I'm making too much out of it, I got to be careful how I do it, because these are words on paper and we don't know, you know, his exact tone, but it seems to jump off the paper to me, and maybe it jumped off different to you, was, it's not alleged, I did it. Like, cred, I did it. But did it jump off the paper like that to you? Maybe it didn't.
Well, it jumped off the paper because he said it, right? Like, we talked about the spontaneous utterances, and you have the right to remain silent. Right? You have that right for a reason. Keep your mouth shut. So, but when he says that, now, so, right, it makes the police's job a lot easier because we know we have the right guy. Even though everybody pointed at him and said, that's the guy, when he says that, there is no, you know, there's not even any doubt at this point. Okay, we know we have the right guy who actually did this because he's saying he did it. The other part, again, devil's advocate on the defense side, they're going to say, well, he said it because he had done it, and he did it because he was afraid. And so he wasn't trying to hide anything. He wasn't, you know, trying to run away from anything. He said it. He told the officers immediately that he had done it, and it was because he was afraid. So that's, again, the spin that's going to be put on either side, right? Like I said, it made the police's job a lot easier because they know they have the person without any doubt at this point. So that's not going to be an issue going forward. Now, going forward is going to be the why.
And he had blood on his hands.
Right. And they make a note of that. He had blood on his hands from the stab. Yeah. So, yeah. And like I said, there are a number of witnesses, right? So the who is not in question in this deal. It's going to be all about the why. I mean, this case is going to be all about the why.
All about the why. And to that point, on the defense's side, this is something I would want to have come out. He actually asked if the kid was okay.
He did. Yeah. So he did. He asked. Right. So that's going to be a point in his favor. The defense is going to use that.
Yeah. That he, you know, didn't know he killed him, basically. That's
right.
How
he killed right. him. Right. So, yeah. So that's why I said it's going to be, you know, frame of mind, all those type of things, making the jury have to get into the head of both of the kids, really. Right. You know, why did Austin approach him like this? And I haven't seen this, Jennifer. Maybe you have. Is there anything that happened in the past between them? I haven't heard anything about that. Did they even know each other?
Well, according to reports, they didn't know each other. But as you and I know, this is so fledgling of an investigation right now. I mean, who knows who's going to come forward and say what in terms of them linking together in some way, possibly. But as it stands right now, never met each other, didn't know each other. And so there's no connection to them, which is also very interesting. And to your point, that it would seem he's in the tent for another reason. And then he gets bravado, right? You're making me move. You're not making me move. You touch me, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, again, you're dealing with young men and there's a lot of, you know, bravado, testosterone flowing. It's all those things that lead to incidents like this, unfortunately. And then it's, we'll see how this plays out in the courts and in the community. You just feel bad for, like I said, you know, both sets of parents and families, having to deal with this tragic situation. It's going to be tough. It's going to be tough.
And I tell you, DJ, again, I'm a victim's advocate. I'm on that side of things. And my heart bleeds for the Metcalfs because he's dead.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Because, yeah, he doesn't come, but you don't get him back. Right. And that's, yeah, to see, like I said, the loss of a life. And especially when it's a young life like that, you just, your heart goes out to the family saying, right, it's, you know, you've got kids, I've got kids, you know how tough that is. So it's bad. It's a difficult situation. But as we know, that's not the end of it, right? There'll, like I said, there'll be other information that comes out and the why is going to be the key deal here.
Yeah, it is. Well, DJ, thank you so much for spending your evening, at least part of your evening, your Wednesday with us here. There's so many questions. There's so many people interested in this case. And I just can't thank you enough for joining me again. I always love to get your takes and your vantage point. It's just important to see all sides, and you always see all sides.
Well, thank you for having me, Jennifer. I appreciate it. It was a great, interesting conversation, and hopefully your viewers enjoy it.
Yes, absolutely. Until the next time, DJ, I'm going to let you go. May justice be served. You know I'll be calling you again.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye, my friend.
Bye-bye.
Wow, guys. DJ is just so good. I just think the world of DJ. He, like I said, brings a very balanced and very almost like a judge, you know, where he really tries to consider both sides. I definitely tend to be on the victim side almost always in most cases. But this case is not going away. And this case is going to remain in the spotlight nationally and in the spotlight judicially, I think, as we see. It's going to be a self-defense case, and we're going to see if Carmela wins and goes home, maybe, or if Carmelo is charged more severely. He's already been charged with murder. His bond is at $1 million. So far, I've seen that they've raised about almost $300,000 for Carmelo and over $300,000 for Austin's family. I post all of this just to keep everybody in the know. I don't think you can ever shove somebody or push somebody and that can ever justify being stabbed to death. That's my view. That's my take. So no matter how you mix this up, unless they say that Austin had a knife or a gun, I just don't think that it can ever justify what happened to Austin. That's my take. But you can bet they're going to fight tooth and nail to get Carmelo off with a self-defense. And we discussed a lot of those different angles. DJ had a lot of good points. Let me just see if there's any, let's see. Yes, you bet, Amy. Thanks for being here. Let's see. I just want to put a couple of these comments up. He stood his ground. Right to stand your ground state is self-defense. I mean, happy fire. We'll see. I don't think you can stand your ground in that way with a weapon that can kill somebody in a tent, at a sporting event, at a school function. I don't think that's going to fly, but I can bet you there's going to be a lot of smart lawyers and a lot of individuals that also believe in your stance. Let's see. I wanted to just put a few more up here. Let's see. I disagree. Well, I wish I could get these to get up here. My heart is for the boys' family. I'm with you, Delta Dawn. And by the way, I love that song. Couple more. Nope, law will not apply here. Just Jennifer, I wonder what you mean by that. That the law will apply here. If you come back, I'll put up what you have to say. His statements touch me and see what happened is what bothers me. It's like he was trying to make something happen. Yes, and he said it twice according to the statements I saw. It was not only touch me and see what happens, then he got touched, and then he said, all right, punch me and see what happens. So definitely seemed like elevating. Let's see, Mary Scott says, you don't know who has a gun or a knife, so you have to watch your step everywhere. It's so true. You know, I always say this, especially like in road rage situations, just in everything, you never know who is on the boiling point and who would have no problem killing you because they're just angry that day. That's just the world, unfortunately, we're living in. They're perpetuating a lie using self-defense. That's from CJK. Yeah, you know, I mean, you heard us discuss it here. DJ was making some good arguments on the defense side. I was going on the prosecution side. I just think it's very unfair to the Metcalf family and to anybody really that if you touch or put your hands on somebody, that justifies murder, as I've said. All right, let's see what we have here. Basic rules, keep your hands to yourself. Shirley H says, oh, you have a 6'1", 225 kid pushing around a 5'9", 130-pound kid. The 130-pound kid is going to get hurt more from the bigger guy. No, there's no doubt, and I brought that point up, that has to at least be considered, you know, how you would feel against somebody bigger. But you also have to consider the circumstances. It's not like you're in a dark alley. It's not like there's nobody else around. You're in an opponent's tent at a Texas track meet. This should have just never escalated like this, I think, is the bottom line. Fake autopsy going around. First of all, if anybody sees an autopsy at this stage, is not going to be real. Toxicology is going to take several weeks, and autopsy, although Certainly, law enforcement knows essentially what the autopsy says. We're not going to see that for some time, for at least a couple, 2-3 weeks. We're just not going to be able to see it from Freedom of Information. So anything you see floating around like that is fake news. Let's see. I'm saying touch me or hit me and see what happens is not a threat. It is a warning. Oh, that's what you meant by that. Yeah. I mean, it seems now we know it was a warning. Weren't the twins football players? Yes. So they were both football players, these boys, Austin and his brother's name, I believe, was Hunter. And it's just terrible. If anybody's seen Hunter or seen the police report that I've been posting, I mean, Hunter was inconsolable. There was no way he could even really provide a statement, they said. He was just so, so very upset. But anyway, we are definitely going to see this continue on a national stage, and I'll be watching it close and keep everybody updated. Thank you for spending an hour of your evening tonight with us, and I hope you come back, and thank you again. And until the next time, may justice be served.